accession number 9826, Reel 2.
Mr. Mistledine, Reel 2.
The American type of aircraft had different characteristics. The aircraft that we had trained on, being the Stearman PT-13, the Volte Vengeance, and the North American 86, which was known in England as the Harvard. So that at Lavington in December, we did a transition course on the Master Type 1. And apart from anything else, it was very, very necessary, because having done most of our flying training on a wide open desert where you could navigate by pointing at a mountain 50 miles away, flying over England for the first time and seeing the patchwork quilt of the ground, it became quite difficult early on to be able to locate your position. So that it was a combination of familiarization with English aircraft combined with familiarization with flying over Britain, which was the object of this transition course. From the Master 1, we went on to the Master 2, and by the end of January, and because of the weather, we had only managed to accumulate a further 8 hours of flying. So at that particular time, the course was halted. And in fact, I note from my logbook that in the assessment of the proficiency as pilot on type, the remark in the logbook says, insufficient time to assess. From there, I was posted early February to Llandow, LLANDOW, which was a created airfield in South Wales, not very, very far from St Athens, which I still believe exists. There, we flew Master Type 3s for 2 or 3 hours, and then, horror of horrors, we were put into a Spitfire Mark 1. Now, up to now, one had always had somebody with one to familiarize yourself with an aircraft, an instructor, before you eventually took an aircraft off slowly, as solo. With a Spitfire being a single-seat aircraft, one day you have to get into it and you have to fly off without any instructor being with you. So that the ground training at that particular point is to familiarize yourself with the interior of the cockpit and go through the drills. I still remember that before takeoff, you used to say TMPFF, which was trim, mixture, pitch, fuel, flaps. This was a checklist. The checklist of a modern aircraft is a book which is read out by co-pilots, but in those days you just did your simple checks of primary functions. The rest of the things like oil pressures and hydraulic pressures and things like that were not considered to be significant at that particular time. So obviously you looked at the gauges, but trim, mixture, pitch, fuel, flaps were the basic things that you always had to check before you took off. So eventually, on the end of the runway, you've got to do your final checks and then open the throttle and find out what this lovely beast was going to be like. Now, the Spitfire Mark 1 was one of the earlier types of Spitfire. And though it had hydraulic undercarriage, it wasn't automatic, and it was necessary to pump the undercarriage up. Now, a Spitfire is very sensitive fore and aft, and you could always tell people who were just learning to fly Spitfires, insofar as that they took off, they selected the undercarriage up, And then you could see them thumping by the attitude of the aircraft, which used to hump up and down because of the pumping movement in trying to get the aircraft up, the aircraft wheels up. So this first circuit went off very well, and one became confident, and so the course proceeded. We also had Spitfire Mark IIs there, which did have the automatic undercarriage, but it had also the drawback of having what is called a Kaufman starter. This is a cartridge used to fire the engine over. That's K-A-U-F-M-A-N. You used to fire the engine over, and you used to pick it up on the throttle. But unless your mixture was correct in the first instance, you would find that it wouldn't start, and you had to move a cartridge round and try again. This used to be a very annoying thing, and I would have felt that as a combat aircraft it could have been disastrous if you had got to make an emergency takeoff. But however, I presume that with experience the pilots who had to fly those in those days coped very well. So that the course continued. One rather amusing story there was that the CEO of the station was Taffy Jones, Group Captain Taffy Jones. He was a little fiery Welshman. He was a 1918 World War pilot. And he didn't like the delay that we had after takeoff in getting our wheels up. We used to gain perhaps 200 or 300 feet height before taking our wheels up, mainly because of this problem of pumping the undercarriage up. And it allowed you to get your throttle settings correct and your aircraft virtually stable. And being able to lock your arm in such a fashion that the stick wouldn't move whilst you were pumping up the undercarriage. He didn't like this very much, so he said that he wanted us to get our wheels up more rapidly. Apart from anything else, it was a safety factor that if you had to force land, if you had an engine failure on takeoff, it is far easier and far better to make a wheels up landing than it is to make a landing with your wheels down. You would just pitchfork if you landed with your wheels down. So that he came out one bright morning and said, right, I'll show you boys how to get your wheels up. He climbed into a Spitfire and tore off down the runway. Now Landau has a runway which runs over the brow of a hill and was also reasonably bumpy. He got part way down the runway, hit a bump, became airborne. Presumably he considered he got flying speed, so he whipped his wheels up and then promptly sank back onto the runway with a propeller flying in all directions. He was rather a mortified group captain. But it was in character with him because apparently, and I don't know the veracity of this story, but in 1914-18, the biplanes in those days were structurally very weak, and it's reported that he used to land his biplanes very heavily to the extent that he broke numerous undercarriages. And eventually he was called up to Air Ministry, who berated him for this incident of damage to a British aircraft, and he has reported to have replied, I have damaged 25 undercarriages, but I have shot down 27 enemy, so I'm 2 up. That's just an aside, but it's part of his character. However, to get back to the flying, by the end of March. I had accumulated some 200 hours flying, of which 126 was solo, and I was posted to 611 Squadron in Drem, D-R-E-M.
Where's that?
That's in Scotland, from the 5th to 4th. It is, I suppose, something like 40 or 50 miles east of Edinburgh. The CEO of the squadron was D. Watkins, commonly known as Dirty Watkins. He was a great character. There I was introduced to the Spitfire 5B and training, operational training, then was carried on in doing circuits and landings, formation flying and this type of thing, and getting to know the area. The job of the squadron up there was convoy patrol in the 1st and 4th, and by the very nature of the expansion of the RAF during this period of time, seasoned pilots, and when I talk about seasoned pilots in those days, anybody who had got a month or two's experience, were usually posted and promoted to other squadrons as they were being formed. So that I found that after being there some 6 weeks, I had become a fairly senior pilot within the squadron. Contrary to what we were promised when we left America, I had not been commissioned. I had got the three stripes of a sergeant, so I was a sergeant pilot, but even so, I was leading sections after a period of 4 weeks with the squadron.
What were these patrols like?
They were very mundane. I think we had more danger from the convoys we were guarding than we did from enemy aircraft, because in those days in the north there, there weren't many aircraft, German aircraft, that could reach the 1st or 4th with impunity. They couldn't get fighter escorts to go all that distance, so you had basically a Fokker Condor to contend with. But the danger was that if you got too near a squadron, too near a convoy that you were patrolling around, you were in serious danger of being shot at by the convoy itself. Aircraft recognition in those days wasn't all that good, and secondly, one had to realize that the seamen down below had the problems of attack from underwater as well as attack from overhead, and these were the types of convoys that went out to Murmansk and went to northern parts. So these convoy patrols continued, and the squadron was working itself up to be reposted down to the south. At that time, if you were in 11 group, which was the central group in the south, the period of duty down there very often was limited to 2 to 3 months, and then the squadron would be sent for a rest to areas such as Scotland, so that they could recoup, reform, replace pilots, and really get their act together again. So 611 Squadron was in this period of reforming in Scotland and would eventually be posted back to the south again. Some amusing incidents that happened, some of them could have been disastrous. I note from my logbook that on the 16th of April 1942, I had an entry in the logbook that the pilot failed to ensure his undercarriage operating lever was firmly in the idle position after selecting undercarriage down, and I was reprimanded for carelessness. But the background of that story was that we were doing formation landings, and the flight, which consisted of five aircraft, were continually coming into this grass airfield at Drem to land in formation. We were being led by a pilot who should be nameless, who persistently came in a crosswind, and every time we came in a crosswind, we got the red flare telling us to go around again and to come in the correct direction. And flying in formation to go around again in a Spitfire is a little bit tricky, because the flaps on a Spitfire have two positions, that is up and down at 90 degrees. So that having put your flaps down in a formation approach for landing, the leader is keeping a little bit of throttle on his own aircraft, so that the people on his wings can adjust their speed and keep in formation. But when you go around again, the leader opens up his throttle and starts to climb, but at some moment in time you have to lift your flaps. Now when you lift your flaps in a Spitfire, the Spitfire sinks about 100 feet. So as you well imagine, that if you're flying in formation, you have got to watch your leader and listen to his instruction and react immediately, so that you virtually all sink together in formation. Well, having gone round and round about three or four times, and the leader apparently not realizing he was still landing or trying to land crosswind, I personally was getting very irritated with him. And as I was flying his number two with another aircraft on the outside of me, I was getting a little bit concerned. So eventually we got through to him that we had got to come in the correct direction, and he made the circuit and we made our approach and landing in the correct direction, and we touched down. And because of probably this feeling of frustration over the whole event, when I selected my undercarriage down, I didn't ensure that it had gone into a locking position. In consequence, I hit a bump in the middle of the field, got a little bit airborne, came down, and the wheels collapsed. So I was left in the middle of the aircraft, in the middle of the field, with a broken propeller, feeling very, very unhappy about the whole event. Consequently, I was reprimanded for carelessness. One other incident that happened there was that we had a station Tiger Moth, and for community relationships with the local army ACAC boys, it was agreed on two things. One was that they would come over and we would take the gunners up in a Tiger Moth, so they can have an aerial view of their sight and what it looks like from an aircraft looking down on guns pointing up at you. And second part of the exercise was that with a flight of Spitfires, we would one morning make an attack on their encampment without warning, so that they would be able to see what their own reactions were. So, first part of the exercise, these soldiers came across, and I was detailed to take them up in the Tiger Moth and fly them around and show them the area. So I said to the CO, well, look, I've never flown the Tiger Moth. He said, well, it's a piece of cake. He said, it's the simplest aircraft there is. Just do a circuit and then take them up. So I did the circuit and found it was a delightful aircraft, even though it was very, very light. And we took the soldiers on board one by one and did a 15-minute trip around. And I think it was about the sixth or seventh soldier that came up. His friends came up to me and said, "Look, Joe, he's been up before once, and he's cocky. Would you do some aerobatics when you're up there and see if you can make him ill?" So I said, "Okay, as long as he clears the mess up afterwards." So I took off and I flew away from the airfield and took him up to 3,000 feet, which is a reasonable height for that aircraft, and did some spins and rolls and Immelmanns and did everything I could to upset this fellow. And every time I looked at him, his thumbs up every time. Great, you see. So eventually I gave up. And having done all these manoeuvres, I had got disorientated from exactly where I was. So I looked for the airfield and looked around and eventually found that I was bang over the centre of it at about 1,000 feet. So I did a circuit and came in and landed, and as I taxied up to the dispersal unit, a couple of my friends who were sergeants came out and walked up to me and said, "Oh, we've just had orders from the station commander to arrest you." So I said, "Are you joking? What for?" I said, "We don't know, but we've got to arrest you, and that's that." So after a while, I began to realise they were serious. So I got out of the aircraft, and they went with me to my billet, and they said, "You've got to stay here until you're charged." So I said, "Charged what with?" "So we don't know." So the following morning I was marched in front of the station commander, and this charge was read out. That I'd endangered one of His Majesty's aircraft, I'd endangered the livestock within an area of 5 miles, I'd endangered a soldier, I'd endangered this, that and the other. So I said, "Well, how do you plead?" type of thing. I said, "Well, I don't understand." They said, "Well, you were doing aerobatics over the middle of the airfield at a height below that which is prescribed, and therefore you were endangering everybody." They said, "Did you have no idea what height you were at?" I said, "No, when you get into a light aircraft relative to a heavy aircraft, you get a distortion there." They said, "Yes, but you've got an altimeter." I said, "Yes, but the altimeter's broken." They said, "Oh." So I said, "Yes, it's only got one needle on it." So he said, "Well, it only has one needle on it in a Tiger Moth." I said, "Well, I've been trained on American aircraft where you have a clock type, a minute hand and an hour hand, where hundreds of feet are shown by the minute hand and thousands of feet are shown by the hour hand." So it's true enough that the altimeter was working properly, but you got such a minimal movement relative to height that I discarded it. So having explained this, the CEO said, "Okay, case dismissed virtually, but you are not a very attentive pilot and you are apt to be careless. If you go on like this, you'll be shot down in no time at all. So pull your socks up." So 2 days later, and I think this was Wing Commander Donovan, who was the station commander, 2 days later, I was asked by the CO, well, ordered by the CO, to report to dispersal, and the station commander, the CO, and myself were going to do this mock attack on these soldiers. So we took off soon after dawn, flew up the Firth of Forth, and climbed over a ridge of hills and descended on this Akak site, and then sped away and came round again to do a second circuit. Well, by this time the sun was rising, the Firth of Forth was absolutely glass smooth, there was a haze, morning haze about, And we were flying in echelon starboard, that is step backwards, and I was the third person. And as we flew up the first or fourth, we got very, very low, climbed up and did the line astern attack, dived down on these soldiers, gunners, turned round and came out for a third attempt. But as we flew out the first of four, suddenly there seemed to be a great splash of water and a bang, and I pulled back on the stick and climbed up to 1,000 feet with the engine juddering like fury, crawled up base and said, "I'm in difficulty, I want an emergency landing." So I flew back at a very low speed, which was the only speed that the engine would seem to operate in any degree of efficiency whatsoever, and made a good landing on the airfield and shut the engine off, and to my horror discovered that the tips of the wooden propeller were missing. So by then the station commander and my CO landed and came up, and the station commander apologized profusely that he'd misjudged the height going up the first or fourth, and he'd got too low, and he virtually put me into the water. But presumably I had a reasonable reaction, and because it was a wooden propeller, a rotor blade, as opposed to the metal de Havilland blade, it broke off rather than, if it had been the metal blade, it probably would have pulled me in to some extent. So, you know, I said to the station commander, "I think we're about even now. You accused me of carelessness," and he laughed and didn't say anything and went off. He said, "I still say that you'll be shot down unless you mend your ways." So, we stayed up.
Can I just ask you, before you go on, about flying Spitfires generally? Talked about the Mark 1 and Mark 2 and the undercarriage, but speaking generally about Spitfires, what was it like to fly them?
It was an absolute fabulous aircraft, and that it had no real vices. It was the most controllable aircraft I think I've ever flown. It was ideal for combat, and eventually during the course of my flying career I think I flew something like 20 odd different types of fighter aircraft, and never one compared with the Spitfire for manoeuvrability. It's true it had some minor vices, such as being a very narrow undercarriage, and particularly when they increased the power of the engines, that the torque aspect of the on the wings tended to push a wing in. It was something which wasn't critical, but you would always find that a pilot took off with his stick over to the right in an element of compensation as speed built up and you got lift on your wings. The fact that you were keeping the left wing up, the port wing up, did help a lot, but there was definitely a thrust downwards on the left wing. To fly formation, it was a beauty. In combat, it was out of this world. But one has to remember that as the Spitfire was advancing through Spitfire 1, 2, 3, up to 5 and 9 at that particular time, which were the common ones, so the Germans were improving the efficiency of their aircraft.